This is Patsy with the Z. Welcome to Joy on Paper, a program for writers and those who dream of writing, and for everyone who wants to know the story behind the book. Coming to you from glorious Clearwater, Florida, the perfect place for writers to write a good book, and for readers to read a good book. And boy, oh boy, do I have a good book for you today. And it is called The Ninth Man. It is by Steve Barry with Grant Blackwood. Now, Steve was supposed to be here today, but he's not. But I am so thrilled to welcome Grant Blackwood to Joy on Paper. Hi, Grant.
Patsy, how are you?
Okay, well, wow. This is fantastic. You must have had a little bit of a surprise when you realized how timely this book was.
Yeah, we realized when we first started talking about it that the year it was going to be published would be the 60th. Anniversary of the Kennedy assassination, so it was timely, yes.
But even more so, I don't know if you expected that Robert Kennedy Jr. would be running for president and doing pretty well.
Yeah, we didn't see that coming, certainly.
So it is very timely that this book covers that period of time, as you said, 60 years ago. It's hard to believe. And when I was reading the book, I kept thinking, now I had heard a long time ago that Robert Kennedy Jr., reads everything written about the assassination. So as I'm reading the book, I'm thinking, I don't know if he got an advanced copy, but I was trying to think how he would feel about reading this story.
Well, it's hard to say. I mean, it's for Steve and I, the primary goal of a thriller is to entertain people. And if they come away being entertained, or not entertained, but educated or enlightened, that's all the better. And this theory that we put forward in a fictional way in the book was actually put forward in a nonfiction book, which readers will find reference to at the back in the reader's notes. We discuss it, but we think it's an entertaining read, and hopefully people will come away thinking that's possible.
And, well, it certainly is. Now, for my listeners, of course, Steve has been on the program a number of times, and they know him very well, and they know, you know, of course, his great books. But why don't you explain what this new series, this is going to be a new series, and it's featuring Luke Daniels. And explain to my listeners the relationship between Steve's other books and this new series.
Sure. So Luke Daniels appeared in The Lincoln Myth, Steve's Cotton Malone, The Lincoln Myth. And Luke Daniels is actually his uncle is Danny Daniels, the president who features in the Cotton Malone series. He gets out of the Army. He was an Army Ranger. And he wants to get in the intelligence business, and so he does a trial run with Magellan Billet, which is where Cotton Malone works or worked, and Stephanie Nell. So he tries out for them. He does well, and he appears pretty frequently in those books. But it came time that Luke deserved his own series, and that's what we're starting.
Well, I think so, because everybody who loves the Cotton Malone series, I think Luke was always one of the favorite characters. So I think it comes at the appropriate time, and then the subject matter that you selected was also perfect.
Yeah, I mean, Steve, I've always been fascinated with the assassination for a variety of reasons. So is Steve, and it's a subject he wanted to tackle with Cotton Malone, but it just never fit quite right. And when Luke came around, all the pieces came together, and we thought, yep, this is going to be a good story.
Well, for you, of course, you've worked with other famous authors. It's sort of your specialty. What was it like to work with Steve?
It was fantastic. Steve and I have been friends since, well, almost 20 years now. We met at VoucherCon in 2005. We have very similar sensibilities about thrillers and what they're for and how they work. And it was hugely collaborative. It was a lot of fun, and I think we got a great working relationship. So I enjoyed it a lot.
Now, of all the subjects to pick, this is a subject that definitely needed a lot of research.
It did. There are as many theories as there are years in between now and the assassination. And so it's a rabbit hole that you can fall into, and it can be delightful despite the, you know, kind of gruesome subject matter. But there's a lot of research, and I think part of the issue is not letting yourself go down too many, dead ends and staying focused on your theory, at least fictional theory in the book.
So for you, how did you start your research? Of course, over the years, we've all seen the films and we've read some of the books, but you had to do a little bit of a deeper dive.
Had to do a deeper dive for a couple of reasons. One, for something that is what I call the most famous solved, unsolved mystery in American history. How do you unravel a 60-year-old mystery of that magnitude on paper? What would it look like, and how would it start, and what steps would it go through? And so that was part of the plotting process. But also, we wanted to portray a group of people that Luke is kind of chasing in one way or another, a group of people that came up with this theory, and how did they arrive at this conclusion that what we portray is what happened? And so it was a fine balance between the right amount of research and too much.
Well, just like any perfect thriller, The Ninth Man starts off with a bang. It's a great introduction to Luke and to his sort of style with this first chapter.
Yeah, Luke gets a call from an old friend / girlfriend, Jillian Stein, and she tells him that, you know, I've done something terrible, I've made a bad mistake, and I need your help. And so he rushes to Belgium, where she's living, and he finds that he is almost too late. Things are unraveling as he gets there, and he has to step in, and he does, and in pretty spectacular fashion.
I love when a thriller opens up with a real thrill at the beginning.
That's kind of the trick, is doing a good hook and getting the reader, you know, accustomed that this is what they can expect for the next 100,000 words.
Yeah, you do. With this one, I was it took your breath away at a moment there where he's rushing in to save the day, and we discover a lot of things about him as we go along, and I thought it was a great opening, so...
We enjoyed it a lot.
Yeah, I could see that must have been a fun... when you come out with an idea for an opening that really is going to grab your readers, that's always a bit of a thrill in itself.
It is, and it takes a lot of practice, and Steve and I have had plenty of that, so...
So you did it. You accomplished it because,
thank you.
As you said, this is the first book, and I think people are going to enjoy it. I think Luke is just a great character. And now, of course, some of the characters are, you know, from other parts of Steve's, collection of people. But I think that Luke by himself is just a great character.
He is, and he's growing. I think throughout the book you see him grow a little bit. He goes from being the really headstrong, impetuous, leap before you look kind of character in the Lincoln myth, and he grows throughout The Ninth Man, and that'll continue in the next books too.
Because I in the other books, Danny Daniels, the president, is always been an interesting character. I liked him, how he's worked through the books.
And Luke, the interesting thing about Luke is that he didn't want any favors from Danny Daniels. He didn't want any favors from his uncle. But his uncle kind of reached out to Stephanie Nell and said, I'd like to give my nephew a tryout from a Magellan billet. And Stephanie agreed, but she said, listen, if he's not cutting it, he's out. And, of course, we all know that Luke did cut it, and he cuts it well.
Very well.
His own theory, yeah.
So the Magellan Billet is the entity that is going to be of very great importance throughout the books?
It is. In this first book, Luke is a little bit at loose ends because Magellan Billet is sort of at loose ends at that point, and things come back together later. But in this mission, he is not completely on his own, but largely on his own. book two is a little bit different. Magellan Billet and Stephanie Nell and the people that work there, they will all appear at various times.
Now, as we said, you know, because it does deal with the assassination of President Kennedy, did you actually go to Dallas? Did you walk those streets? I know if it's still a museum.
Yeah, there is still a museum. The Dealey Plaza is remarkably small, and if people go there, they'll see an X on the street there, and that is where Kennedy was assassinated. And that X has been maintained for the last 60 years. I was actually born in Dallas, and this is...
Oh, well, so you know...
Well, this is an odd anecdote, but my mom found out she was pregnant with me shortly before. She drove down through Dealey Plaza about an hour before Kennedy was assassinated. So in a way, I have something kind of an in utero interest in the Kennedy assassination. But Steve has always been interested in it and seen it. It's largely unchanged, so it's kind of caught in a time machine down there in a way.
Yeah, I know. I've been there, and it's sort of eerie when you think about it. And then if your mind flashes to that moment when Jackie Onassis, well, Jackie Kennedy at the time, climbed off onto the... it's still hard to keep it, you know, when you see that in your mind, it's hard. It's very emotional.
It is, and you know what? There's some debate about what she's actually doing when she's on the trunk. But the man who rushed forward—that was Clint Hill. He was one of the Secret Service officers, and that event haunted him the rest of his life because he kept thinking, if I had been 2 seconds faster, I might have saved the president. Yeah. So this has a real toll, not just in the victim, President Kennedy, but others as well, including Jackie.
Yeah, it's funny that I said Jackie Onassis because I was just looking at some old photos, and one of the photos I was looking at is about it's the restaurant in Rome that's called, well, at the time it was a disco called Jackie O, where I used to go. So so Jackie Kennedy, what she went through was. Still, it's sometimes overwhelming to think about. And I imagine, you know, if Robert Kennedy really does read these books, because he wants so desperately, I think, to finally understand what happened. Can you explain a little bit about the guns? Because this is intriguing.
So, yeah, I mean... There's a lot of discussion. The Warren Report has a certain number of shots fired on that day. Other eyewitnesses claim other guns, but his weapon was a Mannlicher Arcano. It's a 6.72, I think, 6.75. So it's a fairly small round in diameter, but it's a very long bullet. It's a bullet made to really hurt people badly. That's the weapon he used, and the number of shots that hit Kennedy vary. It depends on who you believe. The Warren Report had its conclusion they came to, and I think that they had their own reasons for coming to that conclusion. There's a lot of confusion that day, and I truly, sadly, I don't think this will ever be solved. There, too many people are dead, and it's never actually going to be solved.
Well, it's strange that it was I don't think most people realize that it was an Italian rifle. And a World War II style rifle. I think people thought it was, a fancier, something much different. I think that's one of the things people will find interesting in this book.
Yeah, it was a standard bolt-action rifle. I think he bought it out of a catalog for a ridiculously low amount of money. It had a scope on it, but it was a pretty standard off-the-rack rifle. Bolt-action, kind of World War I style bolt-action.
It is strange. I think it's strange. As somebody who slept with an Uzi under my bed for 40 years and knows a lot about guns. Somehow that I missed that. I think I got to a point where I couldn't read any more about it. That's in the early days. Now I think this book really, you write about it so. It you make such a fascinating story out of it that people will really enjoy reading it. And since he's running for president, he's at the sort of going to be getting a lot of coverage. And so I think this book comes out at a good time for you.
Yeah, readers are loving it, and they're turning the pages quickly, which for writers, that's music to our ears.
So when now. Did you actually go to the National Archives? What do they let you see?
No.
Nothing?
I did not, but I know generally there's a lot of things are accessible. People don't realize you just need to go through their process to look at them. And at one point, of course, readers will find if they read the book, Luke does look at the National Archives, and he finds something very fascinating. But it's an amazing place. I dug as deep as I could without visiting there, but... simply the process they go through for catalog and maintaining all the things they have is pretty impressive.
Well, I think you've done a great job with this book. You and Steve have obviously worked very closely together to come out with another great thriller, and it's fun. I'm sure you're already working on book two?
Book two is we're wrapping it up now. Should be done in the next month or two, and then we'll move immediately on to book three. So book two will... tentatively entitled Red Star Falling. It'll be out next summer, and book three will be out the summer after that.
Well, by going sort of back in history, it gives you some really great opportunities to cover fascinating chapters in history.
Well, yeah, book two, we are tackling a couple things. One is the lost library of Ivan the Terrible, which features into the book, and also kind of a Cold War secret that goes back to the very early days of the Cold War that is integral to everything Luke is trying to accomplish. And again, this is, for him, this is another personal mission. So readers, I think, will enjoy that as well.
Well, it looks like we'll never end with this Russian stories because, you know, at one point, I think somewhere in the early 2000s, I was thinking, well, I actually thought to myself, well, good. Now, you know, we're dealing with Middle East, we're dealing with China, we're dealing with, you know, every place else, and we're finished with Russia.
Well, I think we barely scratched the surface of Cold War era secrets.
Yeah.
So it's ripe territory.
Yeah, I mean, I know. It's so hard to believe that we're... there's a war with Russia again. So, you know, it's like never ending with these people. But obviously you had lots of fun with this. And with your experience, you've worked with some other people who I really admire. Now, did you work with Tom Clancy? I don't remember.
I did. I've worked with Tom Clancy, Clive Cussler. Both those gentlemen have passed on since.
But yeah.
Did two books with Jim Rollins as well. So I've been very fortunate in that way.
Yeah, and well, Clive Cussler, he was on the program, and he was so delightful. It was so much fun to talk to him. He was so enthusiastic about reaching people. He wanted to tell these wonderful stories of his, and it was so exciting to talk to him, and I was really, you know, I feel very blessed that I had this opportunity to talk to him, because I thought he was a terrific guy.
He really is. He was a wonderful gentleman, and, you know, he's the reason I got into this business, so when I ended up working with him, it was yet another dream come true. So.
Oh, wow. That would be a dream come true, because I remember, it was funny, you know, usually when I have writers on, I mean, I talk to them during the interview, and sometimes I will communicate with them afterwards, but he was so sweet. He called me the next day, and I was so surprised, because, you know, it's not usual that an author will call me, he wanted just to talk a little bit more, because some of the places that he had been, I had been, so we had, you know, things in common, and I was so thrilled. I think we had like an hour and a half conversation. I always wish that I could have could have had it recorded because we talked about so many things, and I was so thrilled with him. And as you said, he was a real gentleman, because to do that, you know, to just pick up the phone and call somebody who's interviewed you, and you could just forget about him. But he wanted to sort of catch up and see, you know, well, you were there and I was there, and you know, maybe we passed each other, kind of thing. So it was lots of fun.
Yeah, he's a lovely guy.
Yeah, yeah. Terrific that you got to work with him. So, the ninth man is out, and it's really, I love the cover too. Very, you know, very strong cover. We see Steve Barry right there, but Grant Blackwood is also nice, and they put you nice and big because I think you did a lot of the work, and I'm glad that you get the credit, because you're a terrific writer. You've done work with, you know, some of the best, and that makes you one of the best.
Well, I keep good company, and that's I feel fortunate for that. So
okay, is there like a website where people are supposed to go? Is there Steve Barry website?
Ninth Man. So steveberry.org is where they'll find Steve Barry, and I'm at grantblackwood.com, and all the info for Ninth Man will be at both of those. So
okay, well, again, I want to thank you so much for joining me today. I think Luke Daniels' thriller, the new series, is going to be lots of fun for readers and for everyone who is interested in sort of history, bits of history, because what you've done here, you really have brought history alive. You've explained the period, you've explained the details in a way that is easy to, you know, for readers, and very memorable.
Well, thank you. Yeah, Steve is very good. He has a nice deft touch with history, and I think I've got a good touch with action, and it's such a, you know, a heavy period, the assassination, that it took a delicate touch to treat it with the sensitivity it deserved. So
yeah, and you certainly did. Again, it's Steve Barry and Grant Blackwood's The Ninth Man. And people, this is a really fascinating read, and as I said, it's very timely because you never know with elections. Robert Kennedy Jr. might become the president, so you want to read this book. And again, Grant, thank you so much for being on Joy on Paper today.
Thank you, Patsy. I appreciate it.
Okay. Bye-bye now.
All right.
Bye.
Bye.
All right. We're going to have a book buzz from Rita Moreau, and then some commercials, and then I'll be back with Gretchen Sherrington.
Fellow mystery lovers, this is author Rita Moreau reporting for Joy on Paper with a mystery that will keep you turning the pages. Carol J. Perry's Now You See It. Sometimes 13 is a lucky number, and for fans of Carol J. Perry's Witch City Mystery Series, it is, with this latest installment that features Lee Barrett, the program director for Salem, Massachusetts, local station WICH-TV, In Now You See It, Lee and her husband, Detective Sergeant Pete Mondello, are settling into their new home. The honeymoon is over, and Lee is back on the job as program director for Salem's WICH-TV, recently promoted to historical documentary chief executive. Her first project is to promote Salem's new international museum. Seems easy enough. She loves looking at their collection and doing research about Salem's long-ago days as a shipping capital. That is until the driver of a truckload of antiquities turns up dead. Soon, Lee and Pete are dredging up clues along with a hardy crew of helpers. Aunt Ibby, a former librarian, offers her advice, while a local practicing witch, River North, has some ideas too. And of course, Orion, Lee's clairvoyant cat, has his own ideas. But when a ship model in the exhibit's collection appears to be haunted, Lee will have to dive into her own treasure trove of psychic gifts. For author Carol J. Perry, juggling details and coming out with twisty plots is her specialty. After all, she was born on Halloween Eve in Salem. Special thanks to Kensington Publishing for another great cozy mystery. Pre-order Now You See It by Carol J. Perry and expect the unexpected in a mystery that features a memorable cast of characters and lots of page-turning fun. This book will be released on September 26, 2023. Now You See It, book number 13 in Carol J. Perry's Witch City Mystery Series, is available online. This is Rita Moreau, author of the Ghost and Camper Cookie Mystery Series, reporting for Joy on Paper. For more of my suggestions, go to our website, www.radio-joyonpaper.com. Buzzing off for now.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
Have you ever faced disaster? The Red Cross is always there for you. The Red Cross responds to a call for help every 8 seconds. They have never turned anyone down. Now they need your financial support so that they can be ready to help you when the need arises. Donate online at redcross.org. Thank you.
Are you an author, an artist, an inventor? Then you need to protect your valuable intellectual property. You need Larson & Larson. We have the experience and knowledge to help you with all of your legal needs, from processing trademark, copyright, or patent applications to negotiating licensing agreements and handling litigation. The attorneys at Larson & Larson in Largo, Florida can help protect you. Call us today for a no-cost consultation at 727-546-0660 or visit our website at LarsonPatentLaw.com.
Do you dread being called on to speak at meetings or family functions? Have you envied those who can sway an audience with well-chosen words? Do you know that people who speak well earn more money, earn more recording careers? Gain the confidence to master any speaking situation. Toastmasters will allow you to find your voice. Go to Toastmasters.org to locate the club nearest you.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
Hi, this is Patsy with a Z, and I am back. And I hope my next guest is on, and she isn't, and she better call. Her name is Gretchen Charrington, and I hope this doesn't happen again, because this is the second time we are trying to get her. Anyway, I will talk to her if she comes on, because this is a wonderful book. It is called The Butcher, the Embezzler, and the Fall Guy. And it reminded me of something. Yeah, I'm so happy that I get all of these sort of diversified type books. I get, you know, romances, I get action books, I get biographies, I get all types of books, and I am so thrilled when I get something that just opens my mind to something that I didn't know about. And that's why I'm really excited to be talking to Gretchen in a little while, I hope. And here she is. She's on. Gretchen. Gretchen, are you there?
I am here. Can
you hear
thank
me? Goodness. I couldn't take it again, Gretchen. I lost you.
I'm so sorry. Oh, gosh. Anyway, here we are.
Okay, here we are finally. So, I was just going to start telling people about you. I could have done a whole half hour just talking about you because you're so interesting. But I did want to talk about this book. So, again.
Thank you.
Gretchen Charrington is on, and the name of her book is The Butcher, the Embezzler, and the Fall Guy, a family memoir of scandal and greed in the meat industry. Now, I will tell you, Gretchen, I think, you know, first of all, when you were on before and we talked about a different book, you know, I was thrilled with that because it was about poetry. And I don't know if we're going to get into that one. But I remember telling you at the time that you are such a great writer that I hope you're going to, you know, sometimes when I get a memoir, that's it. You know, I never hear from the author again. They write one memoir about their family, and that's it. I never hear. But when I read that one, and I said to myself, oh, my goodness, she's so good. She's just such a great writer. I hope she's going to write, you know, a novel, anything. Because you know, when you're that good, you want it to continue. But and
well, I was right.
I said, boy, oh boy! You know, after Poetic License, which was basically a story about your father, who was a very famous poet.
Right.
But yeah. After that, I was so happy. You have a really colorful family, so you're lucky.
I do.
You know, my grandparents, well, they were absolutely wonderful people, but they didn't do anything.
Well, that might have been a happier childhood for you. Who knows?
Oh, but you got a heck of a family. And this one, I love the title, The Butcher, The Embezzler, and The Fall Guy.
Thank you.
I'm going to let you tell people about this story, but before you came on, I was going to tell all the cozy mystery authors out there. Sometimes cozy mystery authors get so... They just concentrate on cozy mysteries. They read cozy mystery after cozy mystery after cozy mystery.
Right.
And they're all the same then.
Yeah.
Cozy mystery authors really need to, you know, you can read 50 of them. And after that, start reading nonfiction. Because as I'm reading this book, I kept coming out with sort of sideline cozy mysteries I could have written.
Yeah.
Based on your research. Tell us about your family.
You want me to tell you about the book? Is that what you said?
Yeah, tell about the book.
Okay. Okay, well, the book entails, in a sense, a character study of three powerful men, one of whom was my paternal grandfather, Alfred LaRue Eberhardt. The first one, the butcher, is George Hormel, who started what is now the $12 billion conglomerate Hormel Foods. And the embezzler is a man named Ransom J. Thompson, who worked with my grandfather and George Hormel for the first 20 years of the Hormel Company's existence. So it's a character study of these three men, but within the 20-year period that they worked together, the comptroller, Ransom Thompson, I mean, quite a name anyway, right, for an embezzler, Ransom J. Thompson, during about a 10-year period, he embezzled nearly $1.2 million from the Hormel Company. That was between about 1910 and 1920. And when the embezzlement was discovered, it sent the company into shockwaves. The company, in a sense, was in default of its loans at that point. It couldn't pay back its loans to the banks that it owed money to. The company nearly went under, and if it had, probably 1,000 to 1,500 employees would have obviously lost their jobs, mortgages wouldn't have been paid, families would have been destroyed. And so in the wake of this embezzlement, my grandfather's great wealth at the time was mostly tied up in Hormel Company stock, and he unfortunately lost that stock after the embezzlement, which was required back from him when he was forced to resign. There's complexity to this story. However, the main plot is really about these three men, how they build the Hormel Company from 1900 to 1922, when my grandfather is fired, and the embezzlement that takes place. And the question is, was my grandfather complicit in the embezzlement? I had heard, of course, growing up, that he had nothing to do with the embezzlement, and that he was completely innocent, and that George Hormel was, you know, a mean guy for firing him after 20 great years of service in which he helped build the company to a national brand. But I'd also heard that George Hormel was, you know, he also was kind of an amazing entrepreneur for his time. And at the time, I was working with CEOs, and I knew that not all of them were perfect, that they all had their flaws. and also their great strengths. And so I was really intrigued to sort of understand what really happened, whether my grandfather was involved in this at all or not, and how this company really was proclaimed to be too big to fail by its bankers and given a chance to survive. At the same time, my grandfather was not given the same chance to survive financially and basically lost most of his wealth, which frankly would have been about $200 million today. So, you know, if we'd all inherited that through several generations, I might not be talking to you this morning, but I also wouldn't have had this great story to write. So that's kind of a quick summary of the story.
Yeah, you'd be on some fancy island.
Right, exactly.
with a butler serving you on a silver
platter.
Right.
Exactly.
Yeah, well, that's it. But instead, I think you're still in Minnesota, yeah?
I'm not in Minnesota now.
No, not anymore?
No, I was in Minnesota 2 weeks ago for my launch, and I had made 3 trips out there when I was doing the research for the book, and then went out 2 weeks ago for a very large event, which was just so fun to be back there 25 years later from when I had last been there. So, well, no, I'm currently calling you from the state of Maine.
Okay. Well, now, explain this area, because most people don't realize, you know, how, well, Minnesota has a lot of things going for it besides Hormel, also 3M. So explain this atmosphere that existed. You know, I'm from northern Michigan.
That's right.
Up there, you know, I'm a Youper. We're sort of considered, you know, Youpers are a little bit like this, and we talk a little bit like this.
We
all with that Minnesota, we don't know those people over there because don't understand that they're not the same kind of people as we are.
I'll tell you a little bit about the place. I mean, you obviously know it, but for your listeners, this is the very southern part of Minnesota where Austin is, and that's the corporate headquarters for the Hormel Foods still today. And it was certainly where it was founded in, you know, about 1898 or so. My grandfather started working for George Hormel in 1901. And during that time, but still today, even 2 weeks ago, it is a breathtakingly beautiful part of the country. It is rolling farmland as far as the eye can see. It's sort of like looking at the Atlantic Ocean. There is nothing in front of you but soybeans, let's say. Or wheat, or whatever it is that happens to be growing, oats at this particular time of year. And it's beautiful. It's so different from New England, where I was raised and live. I really kind of fell in love with the land, and I think my grandfather did as well. He had been working for George Swift at Swift & Company, the big meat packing company back then in Chicago. And you know, I've wondered about what could have attracted him to this sort of backwater little town in southern Minnesota when he was working with the biggest meatpacking company probably in the world at the time. And I think some of it was the land. He was a great enthusiast for the outdoors and the wild. And while it was wild in its way, it was simply beautiful, you know, with many beautiful, prosperous farms dotting it. I don't know whether you were trying to do this with your dialect, but largely back then was sort of settled by Danes and Swedes and Germans. And George Hormel was a German whose family moved from Buffalo to Toledo, Ohio. He was one of 12 children. He learned a lot of stiff lessons growing up, very poor. His father owned a tannery. At the age of 10, he was skinning the hides off of hog. I have a 10-year-old granddaughter. It's hard for me to connect such a thing. Not because of gender, you know, just because of age. And but he grew up fast. He left school at 10. He left home at 13. And he, too, fell in love with southern plains of Minnesota. So he settled in Austin and decided to open up a small meat market, really, first, and then wanted to become a meat packer because he felt that was an elevated position from a butcher. He didn't want to be a butcher all his life. He wanted to be a meat packer. They would wear suits to work, and other people, mostly men, would do the hard labor, you know, in the meat packing plant. So he recruited my grandfather into that beautiful place. It was then, in 1900, about a small city of about 4,000 people with muddy main street, 13 saloons. You know, my grandfather at the time was heading up the Swift offices in St. Paul, 160,000 people with trams and beautiful broad streets. And again, it was a risk that he took, I think, to take the opportunity with George Hormel. But on the other hand, he was made executive vice president of the company, which is sort of second in command, and he was given a seat on the board, the only non-family member on that board. So the opportunity was there also for him to really have a great influence, and I think that's also what attracted to him. So that's a little bit about the place. You know, it looks about the same to me now that it did 25 years ago. Hasn't changed much. It's beautiful. Austin itself is a nice, it's probably 22,000 people now or so. Not really much there except for Hormel Foods and the Spam Museum, which is related. So anyway, that's a little bit about the place.
So, you know, this research must have been so much fun for you.
Well, it really was fun, Patsy. I'm glad you mentioned that because it really was. It was probably some of the most fun that I had writing the book was doing the research. And I had two or three things going for me. First of all, George Hormel wrote a wonderful autobiography. And it's actually a great story if any of your listeners are interested in reading about an early entrepreneur in the early part of the 20th century. It's a wonderful read. It wasn't published when I first read it. It now is because several of his grandsons have published it. However, the version that I read is maybe slightly different from the one that's been published, and I'm glad I was able to read his original words. Anyway, I had that. The embezzler, Ransom Josiah Thompson, he also had written an autobiography in prison, where he served 9 years out of a 15-year term for grand larceny, this big embezzlement, which was a national scandal at the time. And so I had his autobiography, and, you know, it too was fascinating. I mean, it's there were many times when I thought, wow, I mean, he sounds very normal and just like you or me, basically. Other times I felt like he came across as a sort of megalomaniac, you know, in search of power, which I'm sure that he was. Complicated man. And then I didn't have an autobiography for my grandfather, but my father had in his literary archives at Dartmouth College four large cardboard boxes of letters that my grandfather had written and received to and from meat brokers, colleagues, friends around the country. He was very well known nationally in the meatpacking industry. And the letters revolved around these last few years of his time with Hormel. So they were perfect for my research. I was able to gain his voice, and I was able to understand him a little better just from, you know, seeing his correspondence. So those were three primary things. Then I made these three trips out there, and I tried to speak with anybody who would talk with me, basically, in Austin, Minnesota, and also in Leroy, Minnesota, which is south, about 45 miles from Austin, just on the Iowa border. That is where the embezzler spent the $1.2 million building first an enormous chicken farm, claimed to be the biggest in the country at the time. I haven't been able to prove that, but many people said that. But turned it into an amusement park over the last, say, 5 or 6 years of his embezzling. He turned it into this vast amusement park.
And I just love this story. It's just so cool. It's
It's totally crazy.
It is.
It's in the middle of nowhere. So he gets known throughout Minnesota as a wheeler and dealer. He's the comptroller of George A. Hormel and Company. But on the side, he's sort of running these farms that he owns. And people kind of question, you know, where he's getting the money for this. But he has a good line about his wealthy aunt who, you know, left him money.
I think it's so good. It's such a good... Really, you know, as I said, I think this book is... You know, maybe you look at the title and you say, what? You don't expect it to be so much fun. I mean, and you learn so much. And as I said, I kept sort of wanting to do little side stories. I think it's the work you put into it. People, really, you should get this book. You learn so much about American history just from reading this.
Really.
And understanding that period.
And I did.
It's fantastic.
Yeah.
And as I said, it's called The Butcher, The Embezzler, and The Fall Guy, A Family Memoir of Scandal and Greed in the Meat Industry. And it's by Gretchen Charrington. And I'm wondering if you have any other relatives you are going to dig up.
No, I think I'm done with my paternal family, in any case.
Oh, well.
And I don't think I would ever write about my mother's family.
Well, you don't know. Dig for some dirt, and you might find it. Because, as I said, you know, I mentioned sort of in passing, Poetic License, the story about your father, Richard Eberhard,
yes,
who was a U.S. Poet Laureate,
mm-hmm,
and I think under Eisenhower and Kennedy, right? Both?
And Kennedy, that's correct.
Pulitzer Prize, and, you know, there was a lot of, you know, interesting things about him to learn, too. But I had forgotten, and we talked about the people who came through your house, but one of the ones that I was wondering was, I mean, did you, I can't remember how old you were, but mm-hmm, did you meet, like, T.S. Eliot?
No, I did not meet T.S. Eliot, no. No, my time started with Robert Frost, basically. I mean, I was 5 when I met Robert Frost, so I knew who he was, I remember him. I met plenty before that, probably when I was 2 or 3. But my era was sort of Robert Frost through Allen Ginsberg to James Dickey. That was sort of the era that I grew up in. And among them, you know, many, many others, Wallace Stevens, Robert Lowell, and Anne Sexton, Maxine Cumin, Mary Oliver,
well,
you name it.
Yeah, I mean,
they were,
it's amazing.
They were all there.
And you write about them in the book. It's called Poetic License. So I don't, you're not working on a third book yet?
I am actually working
you
on
are.
A third
I
book.
Knew it. I knew it. I knew it. I knew it. I can't let you not
but
work.
And it will be fiction, but it will be about another true crime. So I can't promise when it's going to be out. I haven't got a deadline really yet. I'm enjoying my launch right now, and I'm going to give myself 6 months before I make a commitment to something. But I do have a good story, I think, to tell.
Well,
but it will be a different story.
I was going to push you to write because I need you back here. because, I mean, you're writing nonfiction, but the way you write, you're so good. I just,
well,
it's like,
thank you, Patsy.
I'm reading a great novel, and I think it's just terrific. I from day one, when I started reading your book, I said, oh, this is so good. This is so good. This is so good. And
I really appreciate your support and opportunity to talk to your listeners. And I really appreciate how much you read both of my books. That means a lot to me. So if I have another one out, you will be the first.
Oh, you're going to. Once you find that joy on paper, you can't stop. You'll never stop.
That's true.
You know?
That's true. I know.
Mary Higgins Clark was going, you know, strong at, when she was 89 years old. She was 89 years old the last time she was on my program. So,
wow.
You know,
really?
Yeah.
Okay. That gives me some hope.
And in February, I had Eugenia Lovett West was on my program, and we celebrated her 100th birthday.
Wow, is that right?
And she wrote a mystery about cybercrime. If you're 100 years old you can do research about cybercrime and write a really smart thriller,
that
you can
fabulous.
Do anything.
Okay.
Wow. Okay. Well, you've inspired me.
Oh,
definitely.
Okay.
I'm only 72. I have a long
decades and decades. So, Gretchen Sherrington, thank you so much for being on Joy on Paper today. You are a joy.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
Okay.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye. Bye-bye now.
Bye-bye.
Okay. This is interesting. She mentioned in this is these golden threads that sort of go throughout the people that I interview. She mentioned Austin, Minnesota. Most people know there's an Austin, Minnesota, where one of my aunts, my oldest aunt, she was the oldest, my father's oldest sister, my father also came from a family with 12 brothers and sisters, and she moved to Austin, Minnesota, and we thought she was rich. She was the richest of our aunts. She married a rich farmer, and I don't know, maybe he supplied stuff for Hormel. I have to go look at that, but we used to go visit Austin, and she had a very beautiful house right there. Oh, it was absolutely fantastic. And as I said, she was rich. And now my son lives in Austin, Texas. And the caller I had before, the earlier caller, Grant Blackwood, is from Austin, Minnesota. So, I mean, it's all these connections, all these sort of golden threads that go throughout the tapestry of Joy on Paper is, I think it's just really something very, very special. But again, cozy mystery authors, please start reading nonfiction because you'll get more ideas, your writing will be fresher, and you will, well, like Carol J. Perry. We talked today, the book buzz from Rita Moreau, Now You See It, is book 13. And in book 13, again here, it's so wonderful that Carol J. Perry had to do a lot of research about the history of shipping in Salem, Massachusetts. Of course, Salem, Massachusetts was famous for all the ships that came there, all of the wonderful trade that took part in Salem, and she's incorporated that in book 13, which makes book 13, I think, it's phenomenal. It's such a great read. So I hope you will pre-order book 13 in Carol J. Perry's Witch City Mysteries. Meanwhile, just remember what I always tell you. One of the joys of life is to see your words on paper or to hear them spoken in an audible book, or if you're very, very lucky, to hear those magic words, lights, camera, action, and your book will be turned into a major motion picture, streaming video, or perhaps a series on the Hallmark Channel like we are hoping for Carol J. Perry and her Witch City Mysteries. Once the writer's strike is over in Hollywood, I hope somebody will pick it up. Anyway, everybody, have a wonderful, wonderful weekend. It's going to be warm. Go down to the pool and read a good book and say something nice to somebody. And I will say something nice to Big Ed in the control room. Thank you, Ed, for everything. And he saluted me, and I saluted him. And I should have been a general. And if I was, I would be kicking some, well, I can say I could be kicking some tushy. Okay, everybody. Bye-bye now.